clear that at least the Iraqis are taking television cameras and their crews into those areas of the battlefield, the battle zone that they want them to report on. And we have seen on our television screens during the nightly news pictures of burning refineries, burning oil docking facilities, ruptured oil pipelines. I don't know if you've been as fascinated as I have by the choice of images which is coming back to us. What is presented to us by the media is what they think will have an impact on us. Normally, in the early stages of a war, what the media returns to this country are pictures of orphaned children, bereaved widows, or even dead bodies. But this time it's been of oil burning needlessly in the Middle East, the refineries, pipelines that are smashed and broken. Obviously, that's what concerns the emotions of the West. As I watch these black, billowing clouds of smoke and fire, I was reminded of a story which the Bible tells about David, long before he's king of Israel, long before he's a person of any fame. David, as you recall, was born into a very ordinary family. He was one of the youngest sons in the family. He had no future whatsoever. He had nothing to rely on except his wits and his physical power. And so the Bible tells us, in those parts of the Bible which romantics tend to overlook, that David hired himself out as a mercenary officer to the arch enemies of the Israelites, the Philistines. One day when David was home on leave in Benjamin, another group of Philistines attacked his tribe. And he went out with his brothers and his father and their allies to defend themselves, and it's during that attack that he defeated the old grizzly giant warrior Goliath in hand-to-hand combat. But once this was done, the wives and Israel began to sing the praises of David, and his praise began to be heard up and down the land. And he was afraid to go back to the king of Gath, the Philistine king who had hired him, because after all, now he was the famous hero who had killed one of the great heroes of the Philistine community. But he had to return. So when he came back to Gath, he feigned being a madman. He danced up and down as if he were absolutely insane, frothing at the mouth before the king of Gath. And in one of the greatest sides of the Bible, the king of Gath turns to his courtiers and he says, "Chaser meshugaim ani. Don't I have enough meshuganess? Ki hevetem ze lishtagea bi. That you brought this one, this added meshugana, to plague me. I didn't need it." We live in a mad world, and we certainly did not need this added evidence of madness, because that's what it is. The average per capita income in Iraq is estimated to be, even with the oil monies, about $1,200 per person per year. The average per capita income in Iran since the revolution is less than that. The experts estimate that in terms of expended war materiel, damage to plant, this war is costing each of the belligerents $250 million a day, which means to say that they've already wasted nearly $7 billion of income, of assets, each. Now, for all their wealth, these are relatively poor countries. The human resource is largely illiterate. 2/3 of Iran is illiterate. 3/4 of the population of Iraq is illiterate. And what we've really been seeing, if we've had eyes with which to see, is that these two countries have been using expensive Western and Russian explosive toys in order to destroy expensive Western and Russian expensive oil-related plant and equipment. The death casualties have been low. That's not the way the Arab world fights. They've been hurling cannon against cannon, missile against missile, million-dollar plane against million-dollar plane. And all of it has been directed on these great industrial complexes which the West and Russia have built in order to provide the West and Russia with the energy resource which it so desperately needs. And so in many ways, we are the intended victims, we and the Russians, of the fighting. It's a Meshuggah war. It's a war which has to do with race, religious passion, vainglory, revenge, very little to do with what the Germans like to call realpolitik, that idea that war is ultimately an extension of diplomacy simply by other means. There are wars with very limited objectives. The Six-Day War was one of these. Israel was threatened by the massing of armies on her borders. She was being economically strangled by the embargo. There was a need to attack before she was attacked. There was a need to have some bargaining positions for the future negotiations. So the Six-Day War. And once those very limited objectives were attained, there were negotiations, an armistice. The war was over, for all intents and purposes. But in this war, the issues are passionate, violent, and I do not believe that they are ultimately amenable to diplomacy and to any kind of secure arrangement. Iraq was the aggressor, but clearly one of the major reasons for the aggression was the two-year-long attempt at the subversion of the Iraqi government by the Ayatollah Khomeini and his Shiite legions. 50% of the population of Iraq is Shiite. They are the under group, the other Iraq, if you will. The Sunnites govern in the capital. They represent about 25% of the population. It is the Alawite, a minority group among them, who actually have the power. The Sunnis have the Shiites have the numbers, but they do not have the authority, they do not have the wealth, they don't have the control over all the oil wealth which is coming into the country. And there is an age-long struggle between the Shiites and the Sunnites in the Arab world, not unlike the centuries-long struggle between the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, which has lasted nearly 1,000 years and was only really brought to an end in our lifetime. The Shiites are a minority group within the Arab world, but the majority within the Persian Gulf world. They reject the direct descendants of Muhammad and the Caliphate. They believe that there are a number of there were a number of legitimate imams, of leaders, and then there was one who went into hiding, and they are waiting for them, the Mahdi, for the return of this hidden imam, the Messiah, who will come. They're passionate peoples. They are peoples who believe they have the truth. All of Arabs believe that Islam is the truth. The Shiites believe that they alone have the truth. The others are outside of the pale. And so the Ayatollah, once he came into power, though he had, God knows, enough business to take care of in Iran, just trying to make that revolution sound and workable, he turned his interest throughout the Persian Gulf and tried to use his religious influence and that of his followers in order to overthrow governments that he was opposed to. They opened up in Iraq a paper which is called Al-Dawa, which means the call, which is the call to bring back apostates to the true faith. It is the claim that Iraq is not an Islamic, a true Islamic state. They brought arms into Iraq. A number of officials were shot. In February of this year, the present Iraqi government either jailed or executed nearly 100,000 Shiites in an attempt to put down this subversion. Obviously, they were not completely successful. And one of the reasons that Saddam Hussein moved was in order to try and staunch this increasingly effective move to undermine the authority of his Ba'ath regime. Now that's Mashugana. It's madness. There's nothing really to be gained before you have your own economy in order to try and take over other parts of the world. It is a matter of, it's almost like a religious crusade, a medieval crusade. Hardly realpolitik. And in the reverse, when the Iraqi troops went into action, Saddam Hussein announced that he was moving as leader of the Arab world against non-Arab interlopers, to the brew, the witch's brew of race, you were adding the witch's brew, to the witch's brew of religion, you were adding the witch's brew of race. It's the age-old struggle between the Arab, the Semite, and the Persian, the Aryan. There are two racial stocks. They've been fighting with each other since the 6th century before the Common Era. So there's a long Hatfield and McCoy blood feud, which shows how barren the claims are for that there is a unified Muslim world. The Arab states of the world, to a certain degree, rallied behind Iraq because of these age-old passions. Now, Saddam Hussein was moved not only by prejudice, by racial prejudice, but he was moved by vainglory. We have to remember that we look upon the Middle East as a poor, benighted area which has suddenly become rich, which controls oil, which we desperately need, and which has to be placated to a certain degree in order that for our own economic machine, our industrial machine, to be able to operate. If you look at it from the Arab side, what you see is a sudden opportunity to take over the world, to claim the authority that Islam had in the 6th, 7th, and 8th century, when Muslim armies moved across most of the known world with resounding success. Islam, as you recall, moved across North Africa all the way through Spain, was stopped only on the other side of the Pyrenees. She moved all the way down the coast of Africa, almost to the Cape. She moved throughout the Middle East. Her armies went through India, and later her missionaries were to go to Southeast Asia, to Indonesia, and even further. Islam has never given up the idea of the conversion of the world. We in the West, for whom religion has largely become a matter of spiritual encouragement, we in the West, of all religious persuasions, have really abandoned the idea that any one religious tradition has the truth, and unless one comes and accepts the truth, there is no salvation. It's hard for us to remember that there are the majority religions of the world, Islam and communism, are both convinced that there is only one truth, their truth, and that there is no salvation outside of their truth. And they are still, both of them, convinced that the sword and the message go hand in hand, that there is every reason to believe that one conquers and then one converts. Conversion is not simply a matter of reasoning together, of coming and seeing if it's attractive to you and then joining. You conquer, you convert, as well as moving in the other way. Islam is still convinced of its imperial mission. And more than this, all Islamic young men in their schools read of the Golden Age when their caliphs, Abd al-Rahman, Saladin, bestrode the world. And their heroes are these great caliphs of antiquity, and we have seen as oil wealth has flowed into that world, first in Nasser, and then an Iranian Shah, who called himself the Shahan Shah, the King of Kings. Do you remember that great anniversary that he celebrated with so much wealth and pomp in the desert to proclaim the rejuvenation of the ancient Persian Empire, which had once bestrode the world? Now Saddam Hussein. One after another, these men arise who are determined to enjoy the caliphate, to come to an imperial power. Their authority, their prestige, their word will be heard and will become the dominant word in the world. Now, there's an old rule of Middle Eastern politics that when the two great power centers, Egypt and Persia are weak, one of the northern tiers of states. Iraq, Iran attempts to gain hegemony. And this old struggle is as old as biblical days. When Egypt was weak, Persia was weak, the Babylonians tried to achieve power. And this kind of political action has taken place down throughout history. Here was Egypt, caught up with weakness of its own economy, involved now completely with the West, the Camp David Accords. Here was Persia, involved now as Iran in its own revolution, its economy, its army weakened. Here was the opportunity for Saddam Hussein, who controls the third largest deposit of oil in the Middle East, to make his move. And Hussein made his move. He moved to control the Shatt al-Arab, the waterway through which all of the oil of Iran and Iraq move down into the Persian Gulf. He moved, more importantly, to control the little islands that whose cannon controls the access to the which all the oil of the Saudi Arabian, Kuwaiti, United Arab Emirates, Omanate oil fields must pass. If he could control this area, he essentially controlled the Arab and Persian and Iranian world, and he actually, in many ways, controlled the world. Because if he could impose himself on all shipping, through which 40% of the energy which the West consumes must pass through the gates of Hormuz, he then could impose his will on the states of the world and on the West. Iran was weak. Iraq has never recognized the legitimacy of Kuwait. Kuwait would probably be the next to fall. He could easily blackmail the Saudis, who are weak despite their great military machine. All their oil must go through the gates of Hormuz. And controlling the oil, he would control the black gold, which is power now in our world. And so he made his move. Meshuggah, passion, race, religion, ambition, imperial ambition, all these are part of the explosive witch's brew, which is now roiling that part of the world, and in fact, whose shockwaves are being felt wherever people live. But you know, one of the truths about this war is that all madness is not limited to Iraq and to Iran, nor even to countries like Jordan, which jumped to the support of Iraq, or countries like Syria and Libya, which have gone to the support of Iran. We've been mad. Our policies have been mad. There are 12 million Iraqi. Iraq went to war a month ago with more firepower than the combined armies of France and Germany. There are 36 million Iranians. 2 years ago, their military power was equivalent in firepower to the firepower of all of the armies of Western Europe. That their armies have less explosive power today is no tribute to our restraint, but simply to the folly of Khomeini. Now, the Russians have largely supplied Iraq. We have largely supplied Iran with tools of violence of incredible magnitude. And it is these that are being thrown about with great abandon during this first month of the war. What did we think we were achieving by putting all of this destructive power in the hands of governments which have only in the last 2 decades begun to emerge out of the Middle Ages? What were we doing? What was Russia trying to do? We were trying to buy friendship, or rather to buy oil. We were trying to keep our cars running and our plants operating. We were kowtowing to the vainglorious ambitions of people in that part of the world, and we were saying to ourselves, there's no problem. The only real problem in the Middle East is the problem between Israel and the Arab states. There are no other problems. They'll never use these weapons for any other purposes, and ultimately, in some way, we'll restrain that. We'll bring about some kind of accord between Israel and the Palestinians. What nonsense. What madness. You know, there's a line in the Bible, they have eyes, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. How could we believe that the only real issue in the Middle East was that between the Arab countries and Israel? And that if only Israel would be more forthcoming, the West would be guaranteed an unlimited supply of the oil that it needs at relatively bearable prices. The Iranian Revolution took 5.5 million barrels of oil a day out of circulation. The Iraqi-Iranian War has taken another 3.5 million barrels of oil a day out of circulation. Nearly 20% of the world's oil supply has been withdrawn from circulation, and Israel obviously had nothing to do with either contretemps. If you look at the Middle East these last 20 years, what do you see? A united Arab world? United Muslim world? Not at all. You see a world in which Egypt and Libya have massed their armies on each other's borders and have already had several pitched battles. You see a world in which Libya and the Sudan have been at war, in which Libya has sent down its military might into the Sudan to subvert Numeri's government. You see Syrian and Iraqi troops massed at each other's border. You see 10 years of fighting between Iran and the Kurds. You see 15 years of fighting between North Yemen and South Yemen. You see the subversion of by Khomeini of the Shiites throughout the Arab Emirates states. You see 30,000 Syrian troops in the Lebanon. You remember the pitched battles that Jordan fought against the PLO to remove that threat from within Jordanian borders. You look at the reason that Jordan has rushed to the defense of Iraq, and you see it's very clearly they're afraid of the Syrian border armies on their northern borders. You see that the Saudis are terribly afraid of subversion from within. Tranquility, peace, unanimity, an Arab world united? Not at all. Arabs will fight each other with the same abandon that Europeans have fought each other over the long centuries. Why should we believe it to be otherwise? And their fighting now is fueled by the fact that there are great rewards for the victors. The wealth of the world is there to be taken. There are fights between the revolutionary states and the conservative states, between the Ba'ath states and the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a witch's brew, not an Arab world. There's more disunity than unity. And the only thing that unites this world at all is the fact that they have an issue called Israel. And all of these struggles would be taking place if Israel were not there. Yet the West has convinced itself that these are relatively reasonable countries who will do the reasonable thing. But unreason rules in the Middle East. The Saudis have come up with a new oil pricing policy which indexes the cost of oil to a variety of factors, but keeps it considerably above the increase in the cost of manufactured goods coming into Saudi Arabia from the West. It is a costing process which is guaranteed to undermine the economic viability of the West. The Saudi government must know that if the West cannot support it, the 400 families that rule the Saudis will quickly go under. But they continue with this kind of gouging, because they too are moved by more than diplomacy, realpolitik. Gaddafi of Libya has one advantage. He says what other Arabs only think. And in a letter that he wrote to King Khalid about 2 weeks ago, encouraging King Khalid to take the side of Iran in this struggle, he wrote the following. This war is part of the confrontation between Islam and Christianity, between East and West, and between the Islamic countries and foreigners. Chauvinism, xenophobia, religious crusade, racism, all these are part of this explosive witch's brew which is coursing, bubbling, all through this world. In the West, our diplomats are much taken by the calmness and the suaveness of many of the Arab ambassadors and diplomats. And because they seem to be cultured and cultivated people, our diplomats tend to assume that they're operating with the same basic diplomatic assumptions that we are. And what I'm trying to suggest is nothing could be further from the case. We live in a country which has been prosperous for many years now. We live in a country where religious tensions are at a minimum, where pluralism is an accepted way of life. We live in a country which assumes that religion is a helpful device for all peoples and where no religion can claim the keys of the kingdom. We live in a country which has not any 2,000-year-old border struggle with any neighbor. We live in a country where the civilians do not engage in long blood feuds, one family against another. The Hatfields and McCoys belong to the hills of Tennessee and Kentucky. They're not part of the real civilization of America. But in the Arab world, there is now great wealth, great prize. There is the tradition of blood feud. There is a tradition of racial intolerance. There is a tradition of religious intolerance. The Jewish community of Iran was one of the most benighted, persecuted communities on the face of this earth in the 19th century. The 19th century caliphs gave authority over most domestic things to the Shiite clergy, the very group from which the Ayatollah emerges. And such is the xenophobia, which is part of this Shiite tradition, that they look upon the touch of any Muslim, non-Muslim, as polluting. If a Christian or a Jew should as much as touch a Shiite, that Shiite must be purified in various kinds of ritual ways. Jews and Christians were forbidden to be out in Iran during rain, when it occasionally rained in Iran, because if a drop of water would touch the hat or the shoulder of a Christian or Jew and then fall on the person of a Shiite Muslim, that Muslim would be contaminated and would have to be ritually purified. That's the world. Those are the passions, the medieval passions which surge. It took the West, you'll recall, 100 years' war in Europe to finally develop a modus vivendi between Protestant and Catholic. The emergence of the Arab world is just beginning. There are going to be decades of war, of subversion between Shiite and Sunnite, between other religious groups, before the struggle is over. The one thing that the Middle East needs now more than anything else is time. And I'm afraid that the one thing that the Western diplomats are least willing to give the Middle East is time. From the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, when the Arab civilization and Arab economic power was stronger, more viable, more prosperous than that of the West, Islam went into a long, long slide. And we have to remember that it's only within our lifetime that the Middle East has, for the most part, thrown off the imperial yoke. The Baath came to power just 20-some-odd years ago, and they took power from a Hashemite royal family which had been imposed upon Iraq by the British. And many of you have read in the last day or so that the Iraqi soldiers are still using a battle plan which was devised for the Hashemite king by his British generals 30 years ago. It's that recent that the imperial yoke has been broken in the Middle East. And so they're still in a crusader mentality. They still look upon the West as the enemy, to be feared. They are not convinced that we no longer have imperial ambitions. And they are going to show us for all of the indignities which were heaped upon them over the centuries. But there's a problem. cost of the centuries of degradation, of economic lack, has been illiteracy, lack of technical skill, lack of having developed the way the West has done. And so they're still very medieval in their religious views. They're still very medieval in their racial views. Their knowledge of history is minimal. They're given to flights of passion because they react to propaganda. They have nothing to judge propaganda against. None of these problems can be resolved quickly. There needs to be time. But the West wants its oil, and wants it today, and tomorrow, and the day after. A word about Israel. If the West has eyes to see, Israel stands to gain, at least in its relationships with the West. Because the Arab world was till now rather successful in making the case to Western diplomats that the only thing that stood in the way of a continuous flow of oil was Israel. And if only Israel would give back the West Bank and would give back East Jerusalem and would give back Gaza, everything would be well. And so the screws have been turned one after another upon Israel in order to make good for the West. Begin has become the bad boy of West to the West because more than any other diplomat, he has recognized the nature of the Arab world, what the Arab world is really like, that you cannot simply reason with madness, and that though it would seem logical that if only you'll give back the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there can be permanent arrangements, that's not the way blood feuds work. West Bank today, something more tomorrow. I was struck by the fact that when Jordan announced its support of Iraq and took into its airfields for security most of the Iraqi Air Force, Hussein made one of those passionate pronouncements which our great little friend Jordan is given to making in recent years. And he said, "The way to Jaffa begins in Kerem Shahr." And interestingly, they chose Jaffa. Jaffa is not in the West Bank. Jaffa is not in Gaza. Jaffa is simply Tel Aviv, code name for Tel Aviv. The West has eyes and ears, a mind. The West will take away some of the pressure it's putting upon Israel and Egypt now, particularly on Israel, to make good on the West Bank, to give up the West Bank, to find some accommodations for Jerusalem, because that's not the problem. The real oil-related problem is the problem of the Persian Gulf. That's where the oil is. There's no oil in Israel. There's no oil in Jordan. There's no oil in the Lebanon. There's a minimal amount of oil in Egypt. The real problem for us is in the Persian Gulf. And in the Persian Gulf, there are these tremendous differences between wealth and poverty. There's a feudal class which rules in most of the Arabian Peninsula, and the working class of imported workers from Jordan, Palestinians, Syrians, Iraqis, 30-40% of the workforce in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, ready to be subverted. There are the poor peasants of these countries who've always been Shiite, who can be subverted. There's a roiling, convulsive state of affairs. And there's madness. I don't know how you deal with madness. In hospitals, we restrain sometimes the mad when they become too violent. I don't know how the West, or the Soviet if it wished, could restrain Iraq or Iran. The only way I can discover is simply to cut down on the explosive toys that we send to them. That we have a military-industrial complex, and we want to get back some of our petrodollars. Just this week, France announced that despite the fighting, she would continue to send to Iraq enriched uranium for the nuclear reactor, uranium of sufficient consistency to produce atomic weapons. Madness? You bet. Just this week, France announced that she was signing a $3.8 billion arms deal with the Saudis. The most advanced ground-to-ground missiles, the 1,000-mile range. Madness, of course. And we, it seems, have given the Saudis a blank check on our arsenal. Whatever they need, we will send. But for how long will these feudal families rule that country? And can we be guaranteed that they will use these weapons only for rational, realpolitik purposes? Israel has a good case, because these weapons can be turned within a matter of minutes, from east to west. I wish I had a solution to the problems with which the Persian Gulf area faces us. There are some, but nobody wants them. If the United States were to announce tomorrow that we would no longer import any foreign oil, that's a solution. Maybe our economy would go into a tailspin. But we'd not be dependent upon that part of the world. We could deal with them as one must deal with madmen with restraint. But that's not likely to happen. What is more likely, I would hope, is that we double and redouble our efforts to find new energy sources and to bring them online to make them workable. Mass-produce coal energy, synthetic fuel energy, nuclear energies. In measure, as the West disengages itself from its dependence upon the Middle East loses power. That's the only equation that makes sense. But are we willing to do that? I wonder. I wonder how many of you noticed that it is the Saudis who put strings on their oil that comes to the United States, not the United States who put strings on the technology and the weapons we send to the Saudis. What would be more responsible than for us during periods of relative peace to begin stockpiling oil? So we began to do it. But a year ago, the Saudis said no more. And so we stopped doing it. Now, if you want to deal with madness, my friends, you've got to deal cold-bloodedly, calculatingly. You've got to know what you want, and you've got to do it regardless. One of the truths of the Middle East, one of the realpolitik truths of the Middle East, is that no oil-producing country has ever cut down oil supplies below the amount of money which is required in order to maintain its development processes. They know that they've only got an X number of years in order to develop an industrial infrastructure, new industry, new economic base, because oil will ultimately both run out and disappear as the major source of energy. And so they too have reason to want our technology, our skilled manpower. But we don't put any restraints on those we consider our friends. We just keep pushing in whatever toys of vainglory that they may want. We've got to develop, sustain a major energy policy, clearly. We, Western Europe, hopefully the Russians. We've got to know exactly how far we're prepared to use our power. Because power may have to be used in that part of the world in order to sustain our national interests. And we've got to be ready to use that power and to know that that power will be effective if we put it to use. The Bible tells us that David's feigning of insanity before the king of the Philistines was successful. David was allowed to leave, resign his commission, he returned to Israel, and he became the great friend of Jonathan. He enlisted in the army of Saul. Which I guess raises the question, will Israel be as successful as its first king? At the moment, Israel has gained from this battle. It's diverted attention from Israel. Troops are being used, more importantly, equipment is being used and used up. But I'm convinced as I stand here that once this war is over, if it ever is really over, the West and the Soviet Union will push new and more violent and more destructive weapons upon the Iraqis and the Iranians and those that they have lost. They'll want them. They'll have the money to buy them. They'll be sold to them. And of course, the more developed the weapons that are, can be arrayed against Israel, the greater the danger that Israel faces. But if the West has eyes to see, it's for this that I pray. If our diplomats begin to recognize what they have up till now refused to recognize, that Israel is not the problem. The problems are in the Persian Gulf. The problems are with the emergence, the violent emergence of an Arab world. If they begin to recognize this, then perhaps some of the pressure which is now put upon Israel will be diminished. There'll be a chance for Israel and Egypt to work out arrangements together. If other countries want to join, so much the better. The West will turn its attention to the real problem. How to deal with madness. How to quarantine madness. How to restrain the madness that has broken out throughout the Persian Gulf. If you want a prophecy, the war will go on for a considerable length of time. It'll go on much to the surprise of the Arabs, because the Persian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution, is a popular revolution, and there is martyrdom, and there is a martyrist ideology present. It will go on because these ancient hates are there, and even if there are temporary truces arranged for this or that Muslim religious holiday, it will be quickly broken. There's going to be more bloodshed than the Arabs expected. The Iraqis will not be able to establish the hegemony that they really hoped to achieve. But there will be the resupply by the West and Soviet of these armors. And ultimately, violence will increase. To what end? I don't know. The United Nations is powerless. The West has no policy. The Soviet is backing both sides. Reasonable men must run for cover because unreason rules the day. If these struggles do diminish and ultimately disappear, then I'm afraid the weaponry of that part of the world will be diverted to the West. The Arab world will need a whipping boy. They'll need a cause which will again give a sense of surface unity. There's only one cause that serves that purpose: their enmity of Israel. I remind you that since 1947, Iraq has been at war with Israel. I remind you that in the last 2 years at least, the Iranian government has been the staunchest, most violent, most vociferous of allies of the PLO. I wish I could end on a word of hope. But it's hard to find hope in this mess. Madness. The only hope is that there'll be the shock of recognition as such. We, the West, will begin to reposition our policies and exploit whatever small opportunities there are to exploit in order to maintain the energy that we need until we find and develop other sources of energy in order to restrain other countries from pitching in and joining this ghastly little war. Thomas Merton wrote a book called "'Tis a Mad World, My Masters." Haser Meshugaimani, do I need more madness? The answer is no. Do I see reason triumphant? I do not. Is there hope? There's always hope. But we have to begin with little things. We're not going to solve the problems of Sunnite and Shiite, of Aryan and Semite, all those ancient hates overnight. We're going to have to build a policy which is as realistic as we can make it, as extensive as we can make it, but be satisfied with half a loaf. And most of all, I pray that the West at least will restrain itself in rearming these madmen. To see a Saddam Hussein equipped with atomic weapons is something that is absolutely impossible to contemplate. He'll use them. The problem, however, for the Israeli is that both sides are their enemy. But we're alive, The United States is strong. If we won our share of Nobel Prizes again this year, and given the technological skills of this nation, I find it absolutely beyond belief that we cannot devote a crash program which will ultimately break us free of our dependence upon the madness of the Arab world. That's my hope. And God, I wish to God that I were hearing programs of that kind spoken of by the candidates for our presidency, because I'm not. I've given you as much hope as I can.